Chapter 8. The Teachers of the Present. The teachers of the present, sitting on the lotus in front of the Buddhas of the three times, are iconographically closest to us as we gaze upon the refuge tree. This reflects their historical position in relation to the tree, but there is more to it than that. They are, between them, our gateway into the mandala of going for refuge. Through our contact with them, directly or indirectly, we enter the vast mandala of spiritual influence represented by the tree itself. Between them, the teachers of the present represent an assortment of approaches to Dharma practice. There is Chan Vajrayana yogi hermit, a Theravadin scholar monk, a Gelug monk, and four Nyingma lamas. Four of these teachers lived as celibate renunciants, and four with their wives and families. Some of them had their Dharma education in the context of a formal monastic structure from an early age. Others seem almost to have found it out for themselves. Some were born into Buddhist families. Others decided they were Buddhists later in life. Some of them related to Sangharakshita as a personal friend. Others had a more formal relationship with him. All of them, however, exhibit certain similar characteristics. That they all had a profound knowledge of and commitment to the Dharma goes without saying, but among their contemporaries, they all stand out as unusually broad-minded people, strongly ecumenical in their approach to spiritual practice. Sangharakshita had a profound insight experience at the age of 16. Ever since then, he once said, there were few occasions when he did not reflect on the Dharma, and in all his later learning about Buddhism and in all his subsequent experience, he found nothing that caused him to question that first instance of insight. Everything that came after only served to broaden and deepen it. What then did he get from his eight main teachers? After all, he had all but completed the survey of Buddhism before meeting seven of them. And the Theravadin Bhikkhu Jagdish Kashyap, whom he had met before writing it, can hardly have influenced very much of it, based, as it partly is, on Mahayana Buddhist doctrine. This question was once put to Sangharakshita, and he replied that he had certainly gained a great deal of Dharma knowledge from many of his teachers, and had received initiations and information about meditation practices from many of them. But he got most from them by observing how, in the context of their daily lives, the Dharma life was truly to be lived. This process of exemplification continues down to us today. We too can reflect on the lives and teachings of the teachers of the present, if not in the flesh, then through their teachings and the stories of their lives. It is to be hoped that this process will continue in the lives of Sangharakshita's senior disciples, and their disciples. For in the end, it is only through living contact and the practice of spiritual friendship that we can follow these great teachers and ourselves enter the mandala of going for refuge. In their own way, each of the teachers of the present dedicated their lives to Dharma practice and to handing on the great treasure they had found to the next generation. We too, each in our own way, can follow in their footsteps. Urgyen Sangharakshita. Poet, scholar, commentator, critic, mystic, organizer, teacher, and friend. Sangharakshita is a man of many talents and great genius. It is too soon to say how history will regard his contribution to the development of Buddhism, both in the West and in the East. But if the spiritual movement he founded lives up to his vision, it will be judged to have been very great indeed. Born in 1925 to working-class parents in South London, Sangharakshita was confined to bed at an early age, and there he began a lifelong programme of self-education, immersing himself in the classics of Western and Eastern literature and philosophy. At the age of 17, he read the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Hui Neng, and began to have psychical and mystical experiences. Quote, "When I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew that I was a Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arahants are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be, and that I had never been anything else. My experience of the Sutra of Wei Lang, though taking place at a slightly lower level, was repeated with much greater frequency. Whenever I read the text, I would be thrown into a kind of ecstasy." End quote. In May 1944, during the Buddhist Society's Wesak celebrations in London, Sangharakshita formally became a Buddhist, reciting the refuges and precepts for the first time. That same year, he was conscripted and sent by the army to South Asia, where he sought out religiously minded men in Sri Lanka and learnt meditation for the first time. At the end of the war, while stationed in Singapore, Sangharakshita learned that his unit was to return to England before demobilisation. Checking in his equipment, he left the camp and made for India, where at the age of 22, he burned his identification papers, gave away his possessions, and dressed in a simple ochre-stained robe, went forth as a wandering ascetic, following the example of the Buddha. Quote, "As we left Kasauli, it was raining, but as in the course of our descent we emerged from the clouds into the bright sunshine below, we saw arching the road at intervals of a few dozen yards not only single but double and triple rainbows. Every time we turned a bend, we found more rainbows waiting for us. We passed through them as though through the multicoloured arcades of some celestial palace. Against the background of bright sunshine, jewel-like glittering rainbows, and hills of the freshest and most vivid green, this plethora of delicate seven-hued boughs seemed like the epiphany of another world." End quote. For the next 2 years, he and a friend wandered mainly in South India, seeking out ashrams and teachers. While meditating in a cave above Ramana Maharshi's ashram, Sangharakshita had an overwhelming vision of the Buddha Amitabha and took this as confirmation that he should seek ordination as a Buddhist monk. He and his companion set out first for Sarnath and then Kusinagara, where in May 1949 the Burmese monk Yu Chandramani granted them the novice ordination. Full ordination followed the next year. And after a brief period of wandering in Nepal, Sangharakshita settled down for 7 months with his first teacher, the Venerable Jagdish Kashyap. After a pilgrimage together, Kashyapji and Sangharakshita parted in the small Himalayan hill station of Kalimpong. Quote, after weeks of indecision, Kashyapji had finally made up his mind not to return to the Benares Hindu University. Instead, he would spend some time meditating in the jungles of Bihar, where a yogi whom he knew had a hermitage. Perhaps as he meditated, it would become clearer to him what he ought to do next. Meanwhile, I was to remain in Kalimpong. Stay here and work for the good of Buddhism, he told me, squeezing himself into the front seat of the jeep that was taking him to Siliguru. The Nuars will look after you. There was little that I could say. Though I did not really feel experienced enough to work for Buddhism on my own, and though I doubted whether the Nuars were quite so ready to look after me as Kashyapji supposed, the word of the Guru was not to be disobeyed. Bowing his head in acquiescence, I paid my respects in the traditional manner. Kashyapji gave me his blessing, and the jeep was off. I was left facing Mount Kanchenjunga. End quote. Finding the existing Buddhist organisations in the Himalayan border region too factious and sectarian, he founded a new one, the Young Men's Buddhist Association, which offered Buddhist teaching and practice as well as social and cultural activities and tutorial classes to help the young men pass their exams. Eventually acquiring his own property, the Triana Vardhana Vihara, Sangharakshita worked energetically to revitalise and promote the Dharma throughout the region, giving talks and hosting meetings in a wide variety of places, as well as producing a new publication, Stepping Stones, which soon attracted an impressive list of contributors. Lama Govinda, Herbert Goethe, Edward Conza, and Prince Peter of Greece among them, and brought Sangharakshita to the attention of the English-speaking Buddhist world. He also became the principal editor of the Mahabodhi Journal. In 1956, Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar, the great leader of India's Untouchables, asked Sangharakshita to preside at his conversion ceremony. Sangharakshita suggested that the ceremony would carry more weight if it were undertaken by U Chandramani, then the senior-most bhikkhu in India, and in October that year, Ambedkar and nearly 400,000 of his followers duly took the refuges and precepts. 6 weeks later, Ambedkar died, and Sangharakshita, who was visiting the plains at that time, threw himself into the task of rallying the grief-stricken multitudes, addressing nearly 30 mass meetings in 4 days and initiating 30,000 people into Buddhism. End quote. The condolence meeting was held in the Kastachand Park, which was little more than a large open space, part of which was occupied by a small pavilion. Roads apparently debouched into it from a number of directions. For on my arrival there at 7 o'clock, by which time night had fallen, it was the dark centre of a gigantic wheel, the golden spokes of which were formed by the lighted candles carried by the long columns of mourners who were converging on the place from all over the city. As the columns entered the park, I saw that the men, women and children carrying the candles were all clad in white, the same white that only 7 weeks ago they had worn for the conversion ceremony. Whether on account of their demoralised state, or because there was not enough time, the organisers of the meeting had done little more than rig up a microphone and loudspeakers. There was no stage, and apart from a Petromax or two, no illumination other than that provided by the thousands of candles. By the time I rose to speak, standing on the seat of a rickshaw and with someone holding the microphone up in front of me, about 100,000 people had assembled. Under normal circumstances, I would have been the last speaker, but on this occasion I was the first. In fact, as things turned out, I was the only speaker. Though some five or six of Ann Bedker's most prominent local supporters one by one attempted to pay tribute to their departed leader, they were so overcome by emotion that, after uttering only a few words, they burst into tears and had to sit down. Their example was contagious. When I started to speak, the whole vast gathering was weeping, and sobs and groans filled the air. In the cold blue light of the Petromax, I could see grey-haired men rolling in agonies of grief at my feet. Though deeply moved by the sight of so much anguish and despair, I realised that for me, at least, this was no time to indulge in emotion. And Bedker's followers had received a terrible shock. They had been Buddhist for only 7 weeks, and now their leader, in whom their trust was total, and on whose guidance in the difficult days ahead they had been relying, had been snatched away. Poor and illiterate as the vast majority of them were, and faced by the unrelenting hostility of the caste Hindus, they did not know which way to turn, and there was a possibility that the whole movement of conversion to Buddhism would come to a halt or even collapse. I therefore delivered a vigorous and stirring speech in which, after extolling the greatness of Ambedkar's achievement, I exhorted my audience to continue the work he had so gloriously begun and to bring it to a successful conclusion. Baba Saheb was not dead but alive. To the extent that they were faithful to the ideals for which he stood and for which he had quite literally sacrificed himself, he lived on in them. This speech, which lasted for an hour or more, was not without effect. Ambedkar's stricken followers began to realise that it was not the end of the world, that there was a future for them, even after their beloved Baba Saheb's death, and that the future was not altogether devoid of hope. While I was speaking, I had an extraordinary experience. Above the crowd there hung an enormous presence. Whether the presence was Ambedkar's departed consciousness hovering over the heads of his followers, or whether it was the collective product of their thoughts at the time of trial and crisis, I do not know, but it was as real to me as the people I was addressing. End quote. From then, until he left India to spend several months, nearly every year, teaching and lecturing among the new Buddhists of Western India, he personally conducted the conversion ceremonies of more than 200,000 people. Despite all this activity, Sangharakshita continued with his writing, meditation, reflection, and Dharma studies, maintaining a rains retreat at his vihara for 3 months each year. He continued to write poetry, published A Survey of Buddhism, his magnum opus, and wrote both The Three Jewels and The Eternal Legacy. While living in Kalimpong, Sangharakshita met the rest of his principal teachers. Yogi Chen lived there as a hermit. Chetul Sangye Dorje often passed through there, and in 1956 Sangharakshita received his first initiation from him. He later received initiations and teachings from Jangnyang Khyentse Rinpoche, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, Dujom Rinpoche and Kashu Rinpoche. In 1962 he received the Bodhisattva ordination from Dado Rinpoche. In 1964, Sangharakshita was invited to London to help bring harmony to the small but fractious British Buddhist community. Seeing great potential for the spread of the Dharma in Britain, Sangharakshita decided to remain at London's Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, where he was now the incumbent. But his non-sectarian approach and his refusal to fit in with narrow expectations of what a Buddhist monk ought to be turned some of the Vihara's trustees against him, and while he was on a farewell tour in India, he received notice that he would not be allowed to return to his former post. This left him free to start a new Buddhist movement, and with the blessings of his teachers he returned to England. There, in April 1967, he founded the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order with a small group of his disciples from the Vihara. 1 year later, he ordained the first 13 men and women into the new Western Buddhist Order. So subsequently, these are now called the Tri Ratna Buddhist Community and the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. By 1973, he judged the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order and the order to be sufficiently firmly established to allow him to withdraw from day-to-day involvement in its activities, and he moved away to the countryside, where he focused on his writing, as well as keeping up a growing correspondence and seeing many visitors. Ever since then, Sangharakshita has tended to follow the same daily regime. He keeps his mornings free for meditation and for writing, seeing visitors and conducting his correspondence in the afternoon. In 1989, he handed on responsibility for ordinations to some of his leading disciples, and in 1993, he created the Preceptors College Council, a body of 13 men and women to whom he largely handed over his remaining organisational responsibilities. The movement that he founded has grown enormously from its small beginnings. At the time of writing, there are activities on every continent and well over 100 Buddhist centres and groups. Sangharakshita continues to take a vivid interest in the movement he founded and tries to stay in spiritual contact with those he has personally ordained, as well as with his many personal friends. Sangharakshita's approach to the Dharma is marked by its emphasis on the fact of the centrality in the Buddhist spiritual life of the act of going for refuge to the Three Jewels. Quote, "A Buddhist is one who goes for refuge in response to the Buddha and his teaching. A Buddha is one who commits himself. He gives himself to the Three Jewels. This was the criterion in the Buddha's day and remains the criterion today." End quote. His recognition of the centrality of the act of going for refuge also allowed Sangharakshita to distinguish between commitment and lifestyle. What is important is that one goes for refuge, one commits oneself to spiritual practice, and the lifestyle that one then follows, be it as a celibate renunciant, a married householder, or any other, is then a secondary, although by no means unimportant, matter. The order that he founded, therefore, contains people who follow a wide variety of lifestyles. By discerning in this way what is essential in Buddhism from what is peripheral, and determined more by the historical and cultural conditions under which the Dharma is practiced than by any essential spiritual reality, Sangharakshita has been able to create a path of practice suited to contemporary conditions. He has always emphasised the need for people to remain rooted in their own culture, using what is best in it to further their Dharma practice. Thus, he encourages his students to develop and pursue interests in art, literature and music, and to relate their experiences in these areas to their practice and understanding of the Dharma. Perhaps more than any other teacher, Sangharakshita emphasises the importance for spiritual life of the practice of spiritual friendship. Not only with those more developed than oneself, which is common throughout the tradition, but also with one's peers. In the modern world, where so many people suffer from isolation and alienation from the fragmented society around them, this has enabled the movement he founded to develop as a healthy, thriving Sangha. This valuation of the idea of spiritual friendship carries over into Sangharakshita's relationship to the order and to the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. Although clearly occupying a special position as founder and as preceptor to hundreds of order members, he prefers not to think of himself as a guru, with all that that connotes in the West today. He prefers not to think of himself as a guru, with all that that connotes in the West today. Quote, I would preferably not apply the word guru to myself, nor have it applied to me by others. We have in Buddhism the wonderful term spiritual friend, and this I am more than content to apply to myself and to have applied to me by others. Indeed, there are times when I think that spiritual friend is almost too much and that just friend would be enough. The English word spiritual is in any case not the exact equivalent of the Indian word Kalyana. According to the PTS Pali English Dictionary, Kalyana means beautiful, charming, auspicious, helpful, morally good. Obviously, I cannot claim to be beautiful, at least not in the literal sense, and I can hardly be described as charming, though I may be auspicious and helpful on occasion, and morally good to some extent. Let me therefore be content with the appellation friend and stand to the order simply in the relation of friend. End quote. Yogi Chen. Sangharakshita first came into contact with Yogi Chen in the late 1950s while he was living in Kalimpong. At that time, Yogi Chen was living in a small bungalow on the outskirts of the bazaar area. He lived there as a hermit, and during the whole time Sangharakshita was in Kalimpong, Yogi Chen never went outdoors, not even once. Nor did he generally receive visitors. Instead, he spent the greater part of his day engaged in different forms of meditation. At the same time, he devoted half an hour each day to writing, producing a number of books and booklets in Chinese and in English. After getting to know him, Sangharakshita was permitted to spend an evening with him every week. This went on for several years, and Sangharakshita found his teacher to be very communicative. Quote, I learned quite a lot from him, mainly about the Vajrayana and about Chan and Mahayana and Chinese Buddhism in general. I must add that he absolutely refused to consider himself a teacher and did not allow anyone to refer to him as their teacher or their guru. He absolutely would not accept this. He wouldn't accept disciples in the formal sense, and would certainly not give initiations. If anyone approached him for initiation, he would send them along to the appropriate incarnate lama. This did not, however, prevent him from criticizing some incarnate lamas very vigorously, and he was very critical of them indeed. End quote. Yogi Chen knew English quite well and could read almost any English book, but according to Sangharakshita, his spoken English was dreadful. Quote, he had a very, very strong Chinese accent and very strange ideas about English grammar. If you hadn't known him for quite a while, you couldn't make out what he was saying. Even when he spoke English, he needed an interpreter into English. End quote. He was also somewhat eccentric, especially with regard to dress. Sometimes Sangharakshita would find him wearing a kind of cowboy outfit. At other times, a very formal Chinese scholar's dress with a black cap and long grey-blue robe. He was also very excitable. Quote, he was so excitable, so explosive, so emotional. In the end, I came to the conclusion that perhaps lots of energy was generated in his meditation and it spilled over. That was the only explanation I could think of. End quote. On one occasion, Sangharakshita gave him a book on Zen that had been written by a British writer, and after reading it, Yogi Chen shed tears. "To think," he said, "that people in the West are being given this sort of stuff rather than the real thing." For all this, what most impressed Sangharakshita about Yogi Chen was his extraordinary intellect. Quote, "I used to ask him all sorts of questions, and he gave me the clearest replies that I got from any of my teachers. In the midst of all his eccentricity, there was an absolute clarity of understanding. He clarified things that no one else had been able to clarify." End quote. He was also very learned, and once told Sangharakshita that when he was in China, he had read the entire Chinese Tripitaka twice. Some catalogues put that at over 2,000 separate works. His Buddhist Meditations, Systematic and Practical, is the record of a number of conversations between Yogi Chen, Sangharakshita, and his friend Kantipalo, which took place in Yogi Chen's hermitage in Kalimpong. "On this first occasion," Kantipalo wrote, "it was decided that an outline of his biography would be a good introduction to his explanation of practice and realization. So the two monks asked him to tell his story." Yogi Chen replied, quote, "Autobiography is based on the I, but in practice no I is found, so why should we deal with it? All that we can talk about is a certain mass passing through a period of time and being constantly identified as the same person. Though I have practiced meditation for more than 20 years, still no I has been discovered, while on the other hand, voidness does not mean nothing. But one lives from day to day and traces remain. Life is just a continuous mass of traces with nothing that can be held to either by you or by me. But just as the Bodhisattva went to Vimalakirti and there was nothing to talk on, but you have come so far and all this is at command. Under such a glorified condition of you, how could I keep in silence?" End quote. He then related some of his biography. The young Chen was born covered by an unbroken placenta and so undefiled by his mother's blood. Nor did he cry at birth as most children do. His mother noticed in his forehead a depression between or a little above the eyes, an evil omen according to normal Chinese standards, but a favourable sign for a bodhisattva. There were 8 in the family, 4 girls and 4 boys. He was the 4th child, but while he was still young, most of his brothers and sisters died. One day, a fortune teller told his mother that the young Chen too would have a short life. Hearing this, he became greatly afraid of death. At the same time, his father took a second wife and was always running after women, spending the family's money on them and on drink. Fearing death and poverty, the young Chen saw that the world was a painful place. He had no need, he said, to read books to be convinced of the first noble truth of dukkha. It was his own early experience. But much as he wanted to, he could not go forth, as he still had to care for his parents. There was no one else to look after them. A sickly child, he nonetheless studied hard and was always first in school. Eventually, despite many difficulties, he graduated and obtained a post as a teacher in a high school. There he read the works of Venerable Hai Xu, a vigorous reformer of Chinese Buddhism, who blended the modern scientific approach with ancient wisdom. So impressed was he with Venerable Tai Xu that he moved to Shi Kuan to work under him in the new Buddhist college the Venerable Master had founded. He took up the study of the Avatamsaka Sutra and was particularly interested by the chapter on good conduct. Quote, "This chapter sets forth how daily life should be well accompanied by the bodhicitta. When we walk, we should think of the sentient beings all walking on the great path of Buddhism. When we sit, we should wish that all sentient beings are sitting on the Vajrasana," and so on. In this way, almost every action of our daily life is well accompanied by the bodhicitta. "I wrote out the whole of this chapter in good and vigorous style, so that many copies might be made for presentation to others. Since then, I myself have always used and followed these same gathas in my own life, well preserving the precepts of the bodhicitta and constantly accompanied by the bodhicitta itself." End quote. At this point, Yogi Chen took up with a Taoist teacher and studied with him for a time before meeting his first Vajrayana teacher, a Gelug Lama called Gelu Rinpoche, under whose instruction he practiced the four Mula Yogas. To find the time to do this, he had to rise at 3 a.m. and practice until it was time to leave for work at 9 o'clock. At some point, Yogi Chen married and started a family, but he does not tell us when. Instead, we learn that he always longed to go forth and that he left his wife for a time to practice with a Nyingma hermit, Lola Hotuku, who passed on to him the Atiyoga doctrines of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, and told him that he ought to study Chan because its realizations went very deep. Returning from the hermitage, doubts about the Dharma arose in Yogi Chen's mind, so he shut himself away for 3 days to fast and meditate. On the third day, he had a vision of the Iron Pagoda, the abode of Vajrasattva, where Nagarjuna received the texts and instructions of the Mahavarochana and the Vajrasekhara Sutras. At the same time, he realized that the truth could never be contained in words, and all his doubts vanished, never to return. Yogi Chen said that he had 4 kinds of guru: outward ones, such as his Taoist and Confucian teachers; inward ones, such as Venerable Tai Tzu, who taught him esoteric teachings and with whom he read the Tripitaka, and who also appeared to him in dreams and meditations; secret teachers, such as Mahakala, who gave him many instructions in dreams and meditations; and finally, the guru of the Dharmakaya, the wisdom of non-guru. During school vacations, Yogi Chen practiced as a solitary hermit for 2 months in the summer and 1 month in the winter, and although he still yearned to go forth, he was prevented by family obligations. Nonetheless, he managed to find the money necessary to maintain his family while he travelled in Tibet seeking teachings. He had a dream in which the young Karmapa instructed him to come to him, and so he did. Quote, "It is a traditional Buddhist practice that when a pilgrim newly arrives at a holy place, he should first pay his respects by circumambulating it clockwise, thus keeping it on his right side. I was doing this around the temple where the Karmapa was staying, all the time keeping my mind completely concentrated on his mantra. So closely did I attend to this that I did not know some pilgrims had already arrived to see the Karmapa, and while they were in the temple worshipping him, they left their dogs outside to roam about. By dogs, I do not mean the tame ones in Europe, but great hulking mastiffs with bloody mouths like tigers and long sharp teeth. Then they saw me coming and went for me, one lunging at my throat. With my mind totally focused upon the Karmapa, I pointed at the dog with one finger. The dog became quiet, sat down and stared at me. I stood still and continually repeating the mantra with my hand remaining in this pointing gesture. Then many people came running and shouting. 'They will kill you,' they said. I just said I was sorry to trouble their dogs and went along the path with my practice unbroken. End quote. While travelling in Tibet, Yogi Chen encountered Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, from whom he received many teachings. Remaining in Tibet for a time, he wandered about receiving initiations and teachings from teachers in all the principal Tibetan traditions. After practicing in seclusion for a time, he realized that he had to return to China to rescue his family from the privations of the Second World War, and having settled them safely, he lived alone, practicing in a cave for 2 years. In 1947, he made a pilgrimage to the holy places in India and then settled in Kalimpong, where he lived as a hermit for the next 25 years, devoting himself to meditation. During this period, he devoted half an hour each day to correspondence and writing, keeping in touch with people all over the world, and producing 148 Chenian booklets that included sutras, commentaries, teachings, and meditation instruction, and which he distributed widely without charge. In 1972, he moved to America, where he died in 1987. Quote, "The first mistake is not having a foundation of renunciation as a firm base for their practice of meditation. Quite often I receive correspondence from America and my friends. They say that to renounce is very easy for people in the East, but very hard for Westerners. They complain that in the West there are so many things to give up, so that it's made more difficult. To them I reply that the right thing to do is to lay even more stress on renunciation. If a boy finds mathematics difficult to study, the only way in which he can learn and progress is to make even greater efforts. So it is with renunciation. If we find it difficult, we should struggle and put forth great effort in order to overcome our attachments and enable us to give them up completely." Venerable Jagdish Kashyap. In his day, Venerable Jagdish Kashyap was one of the greatest Indian scholars of Buddhism. Sangharakshita remembers him as being of medium height, very dark in complexion, and very, very fat. Quote, "He told me very shortly after I met him that had I come a year earlier, he would have been unable to go out with me for a walk because he was so fat. He used to go everywhere by cycle rickshaw and paid the cycle rickshaw walla double fare. He was very humble, very unassuming. Despite his vast learning, he never arrogated anything to himself. He was in some ways quite a childlike sort of person, very simple in his way of life with regard to dress, food and accommodation. He was a terrific worker. He could work day and night without food or sleep. But if he had no work, he'd simply lie on his string bed and sleep. Hour after hour, he would reason, well, if there's no work to do, then why not just sleep?" End quote. Sangharakshita spent some of the happiest months of his life studying Pali and Buddhist logic with Kashyapji at Benares Hindu University in 1949. Quote, "However conventional Kashyapji's teaching methods might have been, his manner of teaching was unconventional enough. When I entered his room, the communicating door was always left open, it was generally to find him stretched out on his string bed like a stranded whale, sound asleep, for though he could work day and night when necessary, he could sleep day and night too with equal ease. As professor of Pali and Buddhist philosophy, his duties were minimal, and much of his time was therefore spent on the string bed, which creaked protestingly from time to time, and where he slept without benefit of either mattress or pillow. On my coughing or murmuring, "Banti," a single eyelid would twitch, whereupon I would put my question, which was generally on some knotty point of Pali grammar or Abhidharma or logic, which I had not been able to unravel by myself. Without opening his eyes and without moving, Kashyapji would proceed to clear up the difficulty, heaving the words up from the depth of his enormous frame and rolling them around on his tongue before releasing them in slow, deliberate utterance. Sometimes he rumbled on for only a few minutes, sometimes for half an hour. Whatever he said was clear, precise and to the point. If I asked about a particular passage of text, he always knew whereabouts it came, what had come before and what followed. Yet all the time he had hardly bothered to wake up. As I returned to my room, I would hear behind me a sigh and a snore, and before I'd settled down at my table, Kashyapji would be sound asleep again. Bhikkhu Jagdish Kashyap was born Jagdish Narain in 1908 in the state of Bihar in northern India. During his early school days, Jagdish acquired a reputation for being somewhat radical and unconventional. Instead of the respectable Western dress of the local middle classes, he adopted the rustic homespun dhoti and kurta and often went to school barefoot. He did well at school and after graduating with a BA from Patna College, went on to Varanasi, where he enrolled at the Benares Hindu University. There he completed two MAs, one in philosophy and the other in Sanskrit. He lived simply at the university, actively enjoying austerity and growing increasingly involved in the Indian nationalist movement, as well as campaigns for social reform. He joined the Arya Samaj, a Hindu nationalist reform movement whose purpose was to return Hinduism to the basic teachings of Vedas. In order to be free to dedicate himself to the service of his country, Jagdish refused all attempts to involve him in marriage and instead adopted a celibate life. He threw his considerable energies into the work of the Arya Samaj, but he eventually grew disillusioned with it. He was increasingly concerned about the gap between its precepts and its practices, particularly with regard to the caste system. His fellow members of the Samaj seemed to him to be unable to free themselves from caste prejudice. Not only that, he also found the teachings of the Vedas extremely dispiriting. They seemed to him to comprise mainly hymns of worship and a variety of rituals, as well as spells for destroying enemies and attracting love. Where was all the sublime philosophy that the Samaj promised? Later on, he would tell Sangharakshita that the best way to wean a Hindu away from Hinduism is to get them to study the Vedas. In exasperation, he considered converting to Islam. While studying Sanskrit at university, however, Jagdish was attracted to Buddhism and decided he would like to take up a doctorate in Buddhist philosophy. In order to do so, his teachers advised him first to become acquainted with the Pali Tripitaka in the original language. In 1933, therefore, he left for Sri Lanka, where he joined the Vidyalankara Parivena Monastic College. 1 year later, he was ordained into the Bhikkhu Sangha, taking the name Jagdish Kashyap. Kashyapji was astonished by the religious formalism he found in Sri Lanka, and he treated it with great irony. Ceylonese monks seemed to him to be as inquisitive about which monastic sect one belonged to as Hindus were about caste. When asked which Nikaya or sect he belonged to, his usual reply was that he belonged to the Buddha Nikaya. Once a group of monks, not satisfied with that answer, persisted by asking him which shoulder he covered on leaving his monastery. The various Nikayas followed different practices in this respect. "When it's cold," Kashyapji replied, "I cover both shoulders. When it's hot, I keep one shoulder uncovered. And when it's very hot, I don't wear any robe at all." While still in Sri Lanka, Kashyapji began to translate the Digha Nikaya into Hindi, together with his Indian bhikkhu friend, Venerable Rahula Sanskrityayana. Rahula had long planned a journey to Japan and invited Kashyapji to join him on his travels. They set out by boat from Calcutta, taking the Digha manuscript with them. Despite seasickness, they continued to work on the translation throughout the journey until the ship docked in Penang, where the local British Imperial Police detained Kashyapji. They had received word from India asking them not to permit him to travel any further on account of his involvement in Gandhi's non-cooperation movement. Rahula and Kashyapji accordingly parted company, and Kashyapji remained for 1 year in Penang, where he continued the work of translation, eventually sending the completed manuscript to printers in India. Kashyapji got on very well in Penang. He was the first Indian Buddhist monk to be seen there and was much in demand as a lecturer. He learned meditation from some Chinese monks and developed an interest in and respect for the Mahayana approach. Upon returning to Sri Lanka, he retired to a forest hermitage for 1 year in order to meditate. One day he found himself standing face to face with a deadly cobra that was blocking the exit from his cave. This, he said, severely tested his practice of metta. In 1936, Kashyapji returned to India, settling eventually in Sarnath, where he became involved in the work of the Mahabodhi Society. Along with translation and literary work, he now became increasingly involved in social work and became the headmaster of a new high school in Sarnath. He undertook a wide range of humanitarian work in the local villages, helping the poor and oppressed wherever he was able. Such actions were not without personal risk, and at one point, because of his support for the oppressed classes, he became the target of an arson attack. Rather than formally lodge a complaint, he simply went on a short pilgrimage until things calmed down. Throughout this time, his scholarly work continued, and he developed an international reputation. In 1940, he was awarded the degree of Tipitikacharya by the Vidyalankara Parivena of Sri Lanka, and began to teach Pali at his alma mater Benares Hindu University, where the philanthropist Jugal Kishore Birla built him a cottage called Buddha Kuti. It was here that Sangharakshita stayed with him. Sangharakshita was puzzled at this time by the problem of the ego and was much impressed by something he read in Thomas Merton's Seed of Contemplation. There, the Trappist monk recommended that one could begin to overcome egoism by entirely surrendering oneself to one's spiritual superior. Sangharakshita decided to apply this in his relations with Kashyapji, a mild and unassuming man who always consulted Sangharakshita's wishes before deciding on anything. By 1950, Kashyapji finally tired of the caste-ridden atmosphere of the university with its Brahminical prejudice against Buddhist studies, and he and Sangharakshita embarked on a short holiday visiting the Buddhist holy places in Bihar and ended up in the small hill station of Kalimpong in the foothills of the Himalayas, where Kashyapji finally decided to relinquish his post at the university. He determined to spend some time meditating in the jungles of Bihar, where a yogi he knew had a hermitage. There he hoped to become clear about what to do next. In the meantime, Sangharakshita was to stay in Kalimpong and work for Buddhism. Having resolved always to obey his teacher, There was little Sangharakshita could say, and the two parted company. Kashyapji now spent some time wandering in the districts that made up the ancient kingdom of Magadha. This was his native area, and he deeply wished to re-establish the Dharma there. Eventually, he conceived the idea of restoring the Buddhist university at Nalanda, where, after much struggle, he established the Nava-Nalanda Mahavihara, which came to house a celebrated Pali Institute. All this time, he never relinquished his ambition to see the Tripitaka made available in the contemporary language and scripts of India, and he kept up his own translation work accordingly. Eventually, he persuaded the government of India and the state of Bihar jointly to fund a 5-year project to publish the whole of the Tripitaka in Devanagari script for the first time. The project was divided into 3 centres, where 3 teams of his students lived in or near the printing presses, working 16 or 18 hours a day, cutting through red tape and brooking no delay from the printers, even selling his house to release funds for salaries. Kashyapji managed to get the first volume of the series brought out in 1956 in time for the Buddha Jayanti celebrations. Throughout the last part of his life, Kashyapji continued to promote the cause of Buddhist studies in and around the Buddhist holy places. He developed his own friendly contacts with Buddhists from different traditions, actively helping the new Tibetan refugee community while taking his responsibilities within the Indian monastic Sangha very seriously. He became involved in Dr. Ambedkar's mass conversion movement and was particularly concerned with the training of monks from the new Indian Buddhist community. He died at the Japanese Buddhist temple at Rajgir in January 1976. News of his death spread rapidly, and thousands of people from the villages around Nalanda and Rajgir came to pay their final respects at the state funeral organised by the government of Bihar.
Dado Rinpoche. Sangharakshita and Dado Rinpoche became close friends when they were members of a delegation of eminent Buddhists from the border areas that the government of India had invited to Delhi via the Buddhist holy places as part of the celebrations held in 1956-7 to mark 2,500 years of Buddhism, the Buddha Jayanti. Quote, "What used to happen was this. Our government-sponsored train would take us from one holy place to another, and we usually saw a holy place in the morning and a dam or factory in the afternoon. Our official guide would say, 'This morning we're going to the holy place, and this afternoon we're going to the factory.' And if we were going to the holy place, we would always take incense and candles and so on to perform a little puja. One day, perhaps it was Kusinara, the guide said, 'We're not going to the holy place this morning, we'll go this afternoon.' This morning, it's something else. So we didn't bother about candles and incense or anything of that sort, and off we trooped. But it so happened that actually we found ourselves in a Buddhist temple in one of the holy places, and we hadn't got any candles or any incense. And for traditionally minded Buddhists, it's a big thing to turn up at a holy place with nothing to offer. So all 57 people were really quite upset, except Dado Rinpoche. Tibetan monks have got very voluminous red robes, and while everybody else was expressing their regret and being a bit annoyed with the guide, Rinpoche unfolded his capacious robe, and with a big smile, he pulled out bundles of incense and candles and distributed them to everybody. And there was really quite enough for all 57 of us. So he wasn't only mindful, you never seemed to catch him napping. He always seemed prepared, He always seemed to anticipate what was going to happen and to be ready to meet it. End quote. Dado Rinpoche placed little value on the matter of reincarnation. Maybe he was a reincarnation, he said. When he was very young, he had had memories of his previous life, but they had faded like dreams. He never felt like a great lama, although everyone treated him like one. Nonetheless, it occurred to him he ought to act like one by developing wisdom and compassion. In this way, he said, he became a Rinpoche. You too can become a Rinpoche, he once told visiting altar members. All you have to do is to start acting with wisdom and compassion. He was born in 1918 in Dadsendo, in the east of Tibet, towards the Chinese border. The son of a prosperous merchant and his aristocratic wife, and was soon recognised as the 13th Dado Tulku. The name Dado is a contraction of Dartenso, and Dado Rinpoche's previous incarnations had been the Nyingmar abbots of the Dorje Drak Gompa there. The 12th incarnation, however, took up residence at the great Drepung monastery near Lhasa, where he became allied with the Gelugpa, rising in due course to become the Kempo Tripa, or chief abbot, a position of considerable spiritual and political consequence. At his parents' request, the young Tulku spent the first years after his discovery living not far from them at Namchod Gompa, a local Gelug monastery. From an early age, his life was devoted to spiritual learning and discipline. While still only 4 years old, he was expected to rise at 4 a.m. to memorize 8 or 10 lines of verse. Then, before he was allowed his morning tea or breakfast, he had to recite everything he had learned. After that, there was reading or writing until noon, and then he was allowed to play until 4 p.m. That was followed by more recitation and chanting. He had to learn all the rituals that a tulku was expected to perform. In 1927, Rinpoche's family moved to Lhasa, where he was enthroned in magnificent state and ceremony at Drepung, the largest Tibetan Buddhist monastery, where the young lama, Yeshe Londup, was assigned to him as tutor. Rinpoche was deeply devoted to Londup, despite his strictness and the occasional beatings he received. For 17 years they studied closely together, concentrating on the course of Geshe studies. Candidates for the Geshe degree are expected to acquire a detailed knowledge of the sutras, commentaries, and classical texts of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, as well as an understanding of their underlying philosophy. Accordingly, Rinpoche studied the texts along with logic, epistemology, phenomenology, and ethics, sharpening his understanding of the highly stylized debates in which students contested points of doctrine and interpretation. In the last years of the course, Geshe Londup also arranged for Rinpoche to attend gatherings at which distinguished lamas gave initiations or teachings. In 1944, Rinpoche passed his examination as a Larampa Geshe, that is, with distinction, and he was accordingly enrolled in a tantric college whose severely ascetic regime caused Rinpoche's health to give way. Much to his regret, he was forced to withdraw from the college, and in 1947, Rinpoche journeyed to India to seek medical help. On his arrival in Kalimpong, he was given a rapturous welcome by the local Tibetan merchant community. So few high-ranking lamas ever made the journey to India. And after finding a doctor in nearby Darjeeling, Rinpoche's health gradually improved. He made a pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya and, before returning to Lhasa, spent some time teaching in Kalimpong much to the delight of the local Tibetan Buddhist community. When he'd been back in Lhasa for only 18 months, the regent of the young Dalai Lama, having heard of Rinpoche's success in Kalimpong, ordered him to return to India to take on the incumbency of the newly founded Tibetan Gompa at Bodh Gaya. Rinpoche remained in Bodh Gaya for 12 years, revitalising the Gompa, raising funds for new buildings and extensions, and sometimes even working alongside the labourers on the site. After insisting that all who lived there follow a strict monastic regime, Rinpoche began to meet a great deal of opposition from some of the residents. Nonetheless, he was deeply impressed with the responsibility he had to carry at the Bodh Gaya Gompa, especially after the Chinese invasion of Tibet, when he realised that henceforth the light of the Dharma might well be extinguished in Tibet and would therefore have to be well preserved in exile. Every year, Rinpoche left the scorching plains of India for a small house which he rented for his mother and her attendants in the hills of Kalimpong, where he came to play an important part in the religious life of the local Buddhist community. In 1951, he was invited to become the abbot of Yiga Choling Monastery in nearby Gum, which was famous for the beautiful statue of Maitreya, which Toma Geshe Rinpoche installed there. By 1953, Rinpoche and his friends saw quite clearly the weight of the disaster that was about to befall Tibet. They knew that the refugees already in Kalimpong would soon be joined by many others, and that they would find conditions in exile very hard indeed. Already, the children of poor Tibetan families wandered the streets and orphans struggled to make a living. Realising that children who grew up in India would have little sense of the culture their parents had left behind, Rinpoche decided that a school to provide a traditional Tibetan education was badly needed, and together with others he founded a society to raise funds for it. In 1954, the Indo-Tibet Buddhist Cultural Institute School opened its doors. Rinpoche had occasionally considered going to the West to teach the Dharma, but he recognised there were two obstacles. In the first place, although he had managed to pick up some Hindi while working with the labourers in Bodh Gaya, he was not a natural linguist, and language would always be a barrier. He also recognised that his Buddhism was deeply embedded in Tibetan culture, which was very different to that of the West. In 1953, however, he met Sangharakshita in Kalimpong, having previously seen him in passing in Bodh Gaya. At first, he privately doubted whether the young English monk would be able to understand the Dharma in its depths, or be able to follow the difficult life of a Buddhist monk. But when they started to discuss the Dharma, Rinpoche realised there was no need for him to travel to the West. He now had a student who would be able to effect a translation of the Dharma into the terms of Western culture in his stead. In an interview many years later, he said, quote, "If you were asking whether Bhikshu Sangharakshita is the reincarnation of Rinpoche or not, that I cannot say straight out, but I am 100% sure that he is a truly remarkable and outstanding, deep-minded person. I say this because when we used to talk about the profoundest aspects of Buddhism, Bhikshu Sangharakshita had no difficulty at all in understanding them with ease. That in itself is proof that he has a natural inborn ability to understand the highest things which ordinary people cannot understand easily. I did not have any other disciples like Sangharakshita. He was unique in the sense that he used to learn something from me and at the same time practice it, and then he used to teach it to other people. Only a few people can do this, learn and teach at the same time. because most students do not understand what they have learnt and so can't teach it to others. End quote. In 1959, following the Lhasa uprising, a flood of refugees began to pour into Kalimpong. The refugee community was desperately poor. Monks disrobed in order to be able to scrape a living on the road gangs, and children stole in order to eat. All were hungry and destitute, and disease spread rapidly amongst them. Seeing the need, Rinpoche opened the ITBCI orphanage, which soon housed 50 children. He was also deeply concerned about the future of the tantric colleges. Monks from these had been resettled in different areas and their studies had effectively come to an end. So long as the colleges remained closed, the great cycles of tantric texts and rituals which they had passed on were in danger of being lost. The Tibetan government in exile had been unable to resolve the difficulties. Few were fluent in English or Hindi, and they did not understand the complex workings of Indian bureaucracy. Rinpoche was begged to intervene, and within a month the colleges were reopened in Dalhousie. Rinpoche had already fallen out with a Tibetan government officer in Bodh Gaya, who was now actively maligning him. He now saw that his success with the tantric colleges would be interpreted as undue interference in government business. He considered the directness and outspokenness of his character and concluded that dealing with those who held political power would always bring him trouble. Fearing the possible repercussions for his school, his orphanage and his monasteries, he therefore took a solemn oath never again to do anything which would involve him in government work. In 1962, Rinpoche's opponents in Bodh Gaya finally succeeded in having him removed as abbot, and he subsequently concentrated energies on his projects in Kalimpong, where there was still much to do. In particular, the ITBCI school and orphanage were desperately short of money, and Rinpoche was very aware that although they were able to provide some places for orphans, there were still many in Kalimpong whom he was unable to accommodate. During this period, Rinpoche and Sangharakshita deepened their friendship. Sangharakshita was able to help Rinpoche with fundraising, translation and correspondence. Rinpoche, for his part, opened for Sangharakshita the treasure house of the Tibetan Buddhist canon. But the teacher found that he could also learn from his pupil. Quote, before meeting Sangharakshita, Dado Rinpoche had been accustomed to teaching in the classical style, seated on a throne, while his disciples sat below. Traditionally, the Lama is regarded at such times as the very Buddha himself, and it must be difficult to feel anything for him other than profound awe. While teacher-disciple bonds were usually very strong, Rinpoche commented that it was rare for a Lama to develop a close friendship with a pupil. Thus it came as a revelation when he realised that something remarkable had developed between himself and Sangharakshita. They had become intimate friends. End quote. By 1962, Sangharakshita realised that in Dado Rinpoche he had met someone whom he could revere as being himself a living bodhisattva. Accordingly, he asked Rinpoche for the bodhisattva ordination, which Rinpoche happily bestowed, along with a detailed explanation of all the 64 bodhisattva precepts. For many years, Rinpoche struggled to keep his school open in the face of constant financial hardship. In 1985, however, the charity Aid for India, later the Karunar Trust, run by some of Sangharakshita's disciples in England, undertook the financial support of the school, and Rinpoche's long financial struggles were finally over. Around this time too, some of Sangharakshita's disciples began making their own pilgrimages to Kalimpong to meet the great Lama who had had such an influence on their own teacher. Rinpoche always received them gladly, making his time freely available. "I do not make any distinction between my own disciples and those of Sangharakshita," he said. In January 1990, Rinpoche realised that the portents for his own health were highly unfavourable. He therefore undertook a pilgrimage to the Buddhist sites in Nepal, making gifts to temples, monks and beggars wherever he found them. Returning to Kalimpong in March, he suffered a stroke and after a brief remission, finally passed away. Asked about how his own reincarnation might be recognised, Rinpoche said, "The boy must have the same qualities as I have. I don't have ordinary feelings. I have continual compassion for people. Only a boy with those qualities will do." End quote. Chetul Sangye Dorje. Chetul Sangye Dorje, also known as Chetul or Chetrul Rinpoche, is one of the most outstanding Nyingma Lamas of his generation. Sangharakshita met him in 1956. After hearing that Rinpoche was staying in Kalimpong and being told something of his great reputation, Sangharakshita determined to take his first tantric initiation from him. Quote, "What I had expected the famous Nyingma Lama to look like, I cannot say, but on meeting him I received a shock. He was of indeterminate age, perhaps somewhere between 30 or 40. His coarse black hair was cut short like a monk's, and he was clad in a nondescript maroon garment lined with what appeared to be grubby sheepskin. What I was most struck by, however, was his face, which was coarse and unrefined, almost to the point of brutality, and could easily have passed for that of a horny-handed peasant with no thought beyond his pigs and poultry. At the same time, his whole being communicated such an impression of strength and reliability that one could not but feel reassured, and it was not long before the two of us were deep in conversation." End quote. Sangharakshita asked Rinpoche to tell him who his Yidam was, and after a moment of reflection, Rinpoche told him it was Green Tara, and then gave him the appropriate initiation. "Many great pandits of India and Tibet have done this practice," he said. Sangharakshita performed it faithfully every day for the next 7 years. Rinpoche came to some prominence in the West after the Trappist monk and poet Thomas Merton described a meeting with him in his Asian Journal. The meeting took place in 1968 after the Dalai Lama had recommended that Merton, who wanted to know about Dzogchen, seek Rinpoche out. Quote, "And there was Chatrao, the greatest Rinpoche I have met so far and a very impressive person. Chatrao looked like a vigorous old peasant in a Bhutanese jacket tied at the neck with thongs and a red woolen cap on his head. He had a week's growth of beard, bright eyes and a strong voice and was very articulate. We started talking about Dzogchen and Nyingma Pa meditation and direct realisation, and soon saw that we agreed very well. The unspoken or half-spoken message of the talk was our complete understanding of each other as people who were somehow on the edge of great realisation and knew it, and were trying somehow or other to go out and get lost in it, and that it was a grace for us to meet one another. I wish I could see more of Chetrao. I was profoundly moved because he is so obviously a great man, the true practitioner of Dzogchen, the best of the Nyingma Pa Lamas, marked by complete simplicity and freedom. If I were going to settle down with a Tibetan guru, I think Chatrao would be the one I'd choose. End quote. Although they met up a number of times, Sangharakshita found it was not always easy to meet Chetul Rinpoche because he was always wandering about and one would not tell anyone what his movements were going to be. He'd just up and off. He'd never take anything with him and was altogether quite a strange, mysterious character. Chetul Sang Dorje. Chetul Sangye Dorje was born in the Abse tribal group in Kham in eastern Tibet, and at an early age he migrated with the members of his tribe to Amdo, where he began to take an interest in spiritual matters. At the age of 15, he abandoned his ties with his family and went about seeking spiritual teachers with whom to study and practice. He gave up riding, travelling instead on foot, and refused to enter houses or the tents of household people, staying only in hermitages, caves, or his own small tent. In the course of his wanderings at this time, Rinpoche received many teachings and transmissions in the Nyingma tradition. Kathok Kempo Nyagwang Palzang was his most important root teacher, but he received many transmissions from Jamyang Kyentse Chokyi Lodro and was one of the principal disciples of Dujom Rinpoche. When Chetul Rinpoche was about 35 years old, the regent of Tibet, Reting Rinpoche, invited him to Lhasa to teach, and there he developed a great reputation. Large numbers of nobles and others flocked to him to make offerings and to receive teachings. Eventually, at the conclusion of a lengthy tantric initiation, which had lasted for several days, the regent made the customary offerings, which in his case were very valuable. Rinpoche swept them all onto a cloth, tied the cloth up into a bundle, handed the bundle to the regent, saying, "Look after it for me," and resumed his wanderings. In the mountains, he meditated in the caves blessed by Padmasambhava and other great teachers of the past. For several decades, he lived as a hermit and became known as Chetul, one without concerns. Coming and going as he pleased, he traversed the borders of India, Tibet, and Nepal. At the end of the 1950s, he moved to Bhutan and then to India, where he restored a simple temple in a village above Darjeeling and created a facility there for people to enter the three-year retreat, the only such facility to be established by a refugee lama at that time. The day after he gave Sangharakshita the Green Tara initiation, Rinpoche visited Sangharakshita at his rented vihara, and after explaining the Green Tara sadhana to him at greater length, predicted that he would soon come to own a vihara himself. "At that stage, I didn't know I was going to get a vihara," said Sangharakshita. "I certainly didn't have the money for one." Rinpoche then bestowed a name on the vihara to be. It was to be called the Triyana Vadana Vihara, the place where the three yanas flourish. And he spontaneously composed the following stanza. Quote, "In a sky devoid of limits, the teaching of the Buddha is the sun, spreading the thousand rays of spiritual discipline, continually shining in the radiance of the impartial disciples. May this realm of the Triyana be fair. In accordance with this request, made in the fire monkey year, on the ninth day of the first month, by the Maha Stavira Sangharakshita, this was written by the Shakya Upasaka, the Vidyadhara Sangye Dorje. May there be happiness and blessings." End quote. Rinpoche built many temples, stupas and retreat facilities in India and Nepal,
At the time of writing, he is based in Pha Ping, a Nepalese pilgrimage spot associated with Padmasambhava. He has many disciples from Tibet, Bhutan, Nepal, India, and the West. With his consort, Kamala, he has two daughters, but he continues to lead a peripatetic, unpredictable life and to resist all involvement in monastic or bureaucratic structures. Kashu Rinpoche. Dujon Dorje Kashyod Rinpoche, or Kashu Rinpoche, born in 1920, was the eighth tulku of Latsun Rinpoche, who had introduced Buddhism into Sikkim. He was a man of great learning, a gifted sculptor, and a very deep meditator and visionary. Sangharakshita was introduced to Rinpoche by one of his Western acquaintances in Kalimpong. She was a nun who had been ordained by Dado Rinpoche, but had become rather frustrated with him because, according to her, he was not teaching her fast enough. One day she was wandering in the jungle in Sikkim, in quite a distraught state, when she came upon a clearing, and there, sitting in the clearing, was a Tibetan Lama. Since she was dissatisfied with Dado Rinpoche, this really cheered her up. "Oh, a new guru, how wonderful," she thought. She approached him and they fell into conversation. The Lama, who was Kashu Rinpoche, explained that he was the new abbot of Pema Yangtze Gompa, the royal monastery of Sikkim, and that he had just come to take charge of the monastery. According to custom, however, he had to enter the monastery on a certain auspicious day, and since that day had not yet come, he was waiting in the clearing in his little tent for the day on which he would make his official entrance. "Oh, this is wonderful, this is providential," the nun exclaimed. Then Kashu Rinpoche, as was customary, began to make inquiries of her. "Who are you? Who ordained you?" and so on. "I am a French woman ordained by Dado Rinpoche," she replied. "And what meditation practice are you doing?" he asked. "I'm doing such and such practice," she answered. "No, you're not," Rinpoche responded. "You haven't done that practice for 6 months." And it was true. From the time of their first meeting, Rinpoche went out of his way to befriend Sangharakshita, who would visit him in his monastery in Gangtok. Rinpoche also visited Sangharakshita at his vihara, often turning up unannounced. Sometimes Sangharakshita used to function as Rinpoche's translator from Nepali when he was visited by religious seekers. Once an American couple wanted to meet him, so Sangharakshita invited Rinpoche and them to lunch. They asked all sorts of questions and Rinpoche replied. Some of the questions concerned quite technical and abstruse points, such as the nature of nirvana and so on. And as the conversation flowed on, Sangharakshita suddenly realised that Rinpoche was answering their questions without waiting for him to translate. Since Rinpoche knew not a word of English, Sangharakshita concluded that he must have been telepathic. Apart from Yogi Chen, Sangharakshita believes that of all his teachers, Kashu Rinpoche was the one most committed to meditation. He relied very much on the inspiration it gave him and would act upon any vision that arose in the course of his practice. Once, when he was staying at the Triana Vadana Vihara, he told Sangharakshita at breakfast, "In my meditation this morning, I saw a banner of victory on the roof of your vihara. We've got to put one there." So he went straight to the bazaar, saw the carpenter and had a frame made. Went to the cloth merchant and got all the different coloured silks. Went to the tailor and had it all stitched up, and then returned and erected it himself on the roof of the vihara with all the necessary ceremonies and offerings. That, Sangharakshita said, was typical of him.
Kashu Rinpoche urged Sangharakshita to ask Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro for initiations. After these had been given, Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche handed Sangharakshita over, as it were, to Kashu Rinpoche for further teaching, insisting especially that he be given the Padmasambhava initiation. In 1962, Rinpoche came to stay for a time at Sangharakshita's Vihara and gave him the Padmasambhava initiation. He also gave him the name Urgyan, the Tibetan version of the Sanskrit Udayana, Padmasambhava's mythical homeland. The day after the initiation, as we saw earlier, Sangharakshita came upon a Tibetan monk selling a few woodblock prints of Tibetan script in the local bazaar. Wanting to help the man, who was clearly destitute, Sangharakshita gave him what money he had in exchange for texts. Returning to the Vihara, he showed them to Rinpoche, who was delighted to find that they were Nyingma texts, mainly concerned with Padmasambhava. One of the texts was the Tharpe Delam, or Easy Path to Emancipation, which, among other things, gives an account of the four foundation yogas. In particular, it described the going for refuge and prostration practice based on a refuge tree which centred upon Padmasambhava. After obtaining Kashyu Rinpoche's permission, Sangharakshita translated the text with the help of Dado Rinpoche and took up the prostration practice for the remainder of his stay in Kalimpong. Despite giving him several initiations and therefore standing in a formal guru-disciple relationship to him, Rinpoche continued to be very much a friend to Sangharakshita. Quote, "He was by nature a very cheerful, very lively, very unassuming person, very warm-hearted. But unlike my other teachers, he was a bit rough, not very polished or elegant, a bit rough and ready, but very good-hearted, very warm-hearted, very generous, very communicative, and with an earthy sense of humour. He was deeply, very deeply devoted to Khyentse Rinpoche and to the Nyingma tradition." End quote. Kashyu Rinpoche died on the 4th of July 1981 in Kathmandu while he was there for medical treatment. Dujom Rinpoche. Dujom Rinpoche was a great scholar and gifted meditator. After so many leading lamas from the Tibetan community had gone into exile, the Dalai Lama decided to appoint heads for the different schools in order to help preserve harmony among them, and he asked Dujom Rinpoche to assume the post of head of the Nyingma school. Sangharakshita met Rinpoche in Kalimpong, where he was staying in rather regal style with his wife and family. Sangharakshita received a number of initiations from him. Quote, "Dujom Rinpoche was very much the tantric guru, unafraid of worldly powers. He would sometimes dress in Western clothes, such as Hawaiian shirts, with a huge wad of notes in his top pocket. He gave me the Vajrasattva initiation wearing a cowboy hat. He had been married a number of times and was rather fond of whisky, although I never heard of him being intoxicated." End quote. Dujom Rinpoche was born in 1904 in the Pimako region on the frontier of Tibet into an aristocratic family. His predecessor, the great Rime master Dujong Lingpa, was still alive when he was born, but gave very precise instructions to his followers on how to discover his next reincarnation. "Go to the secret region of Pemako," he told them. "Before you young ones get there, I, the old one, will already be there." And so it was. When they arrived in Pemako, they found his reincarnation. The young Dujom Rinpoche was a spiritually gifted child From the age of 5, it is claimed, he began discovering termas. He quickly mastered many complex teachings and was able to give empowerments and oral transmissions on the collected treasure texts of the Nyingma lineage by the age of 14. From then on, he gave major empowerments relating to the different treasure cycles and composed many sadhanas. He wrote commentaries both on his predecessor's teachings and on his own termas, and, age 17, composed a celebrated treatise on Dzogchen. He became widely renowned as a scholar and meditation master and developed a huge following of students in Tibet and throughout the Himalayan region. In his teaching, he stressed the Dzogchen view. Quote, "Since pure awareness of nowness is the real Buddha, in openness and contentment, I found the Lama in my heart. When we realize this unending natural mind is the very nature of the Lama, then there is no need for attached grasping or weeping prayers or artificial complaints. By simply relaxing in this uncontrived, open and natural state, we obtain the blessing of aimless self-liberation of whatever arises." End quote. Foreseeing the coming Chinese invasion, he and his family left Tibet for India in 1958. It was here in Kalimpong that Sogyal Rinpoche first met him. Quote, "He was small, with a beautiful and gentle face, exquisite hands, and a delicate, almost feminine presence. He wore his hair long and tied up like a yogin in a knot. His eyes always glittered with secret amusement. His voice seemed like the voice of compassion itself, soft and a little hoarse." End quote. After his arrival in India, Rinpoche established many temples and monasteries, including impressive foundations in Kalimpong, Orissa, Rewalsa, and at Bodhnath in Nepal. He had a huge following in India, where he strongly encouraged the exiled Tibetan community to study the Nyingma tradition. His literary output was prodigious and includes the compendious 2 volumes on the Nyingma School of Tibetan Buddhism, which has been published in the West. In the final phase of his teaching, Rinpoche travelled extensively in the West, giving formal Dharma teachings and initiations and personally supervising students in their meditation practice and on retreat. He established meditation and retreat centres in France, Hong Kong and the United States. Rinpoche was, however, not uncritical of Western values. Quote, "One day he was driving through France with his wife, admiring the countryside as they went along. They passed a long cemetery, which had been freshly painted and decorated with flowers. Dujon Rinpoche's wife said, 'Rinpoche, look how everything in the West is so neat and clean. Even the places where they keep corpses are spotless. In the East, not even the houses that people live in are anything like as clean as this.' 'Ah, yes,' he replied, 'that's true. This is such a civilized country. They have such marvelous houses for dead corpses. But haven't you noticed they have such wonderful houses for the living corpses too?'" End quote. Rinpoche died in the Dordogne region of France in 1987, and his embalmed body was placed in a specially constructed stupa in Bodhnath, Nepal, in 1989. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Sangharakshita met Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in Kalimpong in 1959. Having just come into exile in India and having fled Tibet rather suddenly and without preparation, the previously wealthy aristocratic Lama was living in great poverty. But this seemed not to disturb him at all, nor did it curb his innate generosity. Quote, "He was a very gentle, very kindly person, and a very great scholar. He was always reading. Whenever I went to see him, he always had a book in his hand, which he put aside as I entered. I used to study with him, and our relationship was always of a teacher-pupil kind. I received many initiations from him, including the Amitabha initiation. He was a very humble, very unassuming person, who never made much of a splash, who never looked for disciples. I must mention that both he and his wife, in fact the whole family, were very, very tall, at least 6.5 feet. They were absolute giants. After he came out of Tibet, he was very, very poor. When I left Kalimpong for the West, I went to visit Dilgo Khyentse and his wife, and they gave me a knife as a leaving present. This was all they had in their house to give at that time." End quote. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was born in 1910, the fourth son of the Dilgo family, which traces its descent from King Trisong Detsen. Even before his birth, the great Lama Mipham Rinpoche took an active interest in the fourth child of this noble family, and shortly after his birth, the Lama blessed the boy by performing a Manjushri empowerment ceremony and undertaking to take care of him throughout all his future lives. "I feel that this blessing of his was the single most important event in my life," Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche later wrote in his autobiography. One of the principal lamas of the Dilgo family was the great Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo, who died in 1892, and when the boy was 1 year old, Lhota Wangpo, the foremost Shakya disciple of Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo, came to pay them a visit. He immediately recognised their fourth child as an emanation of his teacher, Mipham Rinpoche. However, counselled that the recognition should not be made public, as it might provoke obstacles. On several occasions after that, various lamas recognised the boy's outstanding qualities, but his father objected strongly. "The lamas won't let me keep this son, but I'm not going to let him become a lama. We have a large family estate and much land to look after. I want him to remain a layman so that he can take care of it all." When he was 10 years old, the young boy was badly scalded in an accident and became seriously ill. "What ceremonies will help you get better?" his father asked. "If there's anything that can save your life, we must do it." The lad very much wanted to become a monk, so he replied, "It would help if I could wear monk's robes." His father complied, and the child recovered. For the next 2 years, he trained as a monk with various accomplished teachers in the Nyingma tradition. And when he was 12, Sheshen Gyaltsap Rinpoche formally recognised him as the mind emanation of Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo. Dilgo Khyentse spent the next 5 years living under the guidance of Gyaltsap Rinpoche at Sheshen, one of the six principal Nyingma monasteries, studying with him and with Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro, who, although 17 years older than Dilgo Khyentse, was also an emanation of Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo. Gyaltsap Rinpoche made a profound impression on the youth. Quote, "While he was giving empowerments, I was often overwhelmed by the splendour and magnificence of his expression and his eyes, as with a gesture pointing in my direction, he introduced the nature of mind. I felt that, apart from my own feeble devotion that made me see the teacher as an ordinary man, this was in fact exactly the same as the great guru Padmasambhava himself giving empowerments to the 25 disciples. My confidence grew stronger and stronger, and when again he would gaze and point at me asking, 'What is the nature of mind?' I would think with great devotion, 'This is truly a great yogi who can see the absolute nature of reality,' and began to understand myself and how to meditate." End quote. Returning home, he practiced alone in a cave for a time and received teachings from other lamas. He then received a letter from his father telling him that Gyaltsap Rinpoche had died. Quote, "For a moment, my mind went blank. Then suddenly the memory of my teacher arose so strongly that I was overwhelmed and wept. That day I felt as though my heart had been torn from my chest. I went back to Den Khok and started a period of retreat in the mountains that would last 13 years. End quote. Shishen Gyaltsap had given the young Khyentse Rinpoche many teachings and had shown him the true nature of his own mind. He in turn had promised his teacher that he would show the same unstinting generosity to all who asked him for instruction. In order to prepare himself, he spent the next 13 years in silent retreat. Quote, "I practiced from the early hours before dawn until noon, and from afternoon until late into the night. At midday, I read from my books, reciting the texts aloud to learn them by heart. I lived in the cave at Cliff Hermitage without coming out of retreat for 7 years. I was 16 when I started that retreat. I sat all the time in a four-sided wooden box, occasionally stretching my legs out. Shedrup, my elder brother, was my retreat teacher, and he told me that unless I sometimes took a walk outside, I might end up deranged, but I felt not the slightest wish to go out." End quote. During this period, Khyentse Rinpoche became seriously ill. Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro and several other lamas unanimously agreed that the time had come for him to take a consort, as was necessary for him as a Tertön, a finder of the spiritual treasures concealed by Padmasambhava. Accordingly, he married Lamo, a simple girl from an ordinary farming family. From then on, his health improved. He had many deep visions and revealed many of the mind treasures of Padmasambhava. After completing his retreat at the age of 28, Khyentse Rinpoche spent many years with Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro, whom he thought of as his second main teacher. After receiving a cycle of empowerments from him, Khyentse Rinpoche expressed the desire to spend the rest of his life in solitary retreat. But his teacher was adamant. "Your mind and mine are one," he said. "The time has come for you to teach and transmit to others the countless precious teachings you have received." From then on, Khyentse Rinpoche worked constantly for the benefit of living beings. In 1959, the Dilgo estates in Kham were confiscated by the Chinese, and Rinpoche and his family barely escaped to Bhutan. He arrived in Sikkim, penniless, just in time to perform the cremation of Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro, who had recently died, and he went on to stay in the Kalimpong and Darjeeling region, where he met and exchanged teachings with other great lamas, such as Dujong Rinpoche and Kangyur Rinpoche. At the request of the royal family, Rinpoche went to live in Bhutan, where he became a schoolteacher near the capital. Disciples gradually became drawn to him, and he became the foremost Buddhist teacher in the kingdom, revered by all, from the king to the humblest peasant. Around this time, he also became one of the main teachers of the Dalai Lama, offering him most of the major teachings from the Nyingma tradition. He refounded Shechen Monastery, building a magnificent complex near the great stupa at Bodhnath in Nepal, and he travelled extensively, visiting Tibet twice and the West several times. Wherever he was, he would rise before dawn to pray and meditate for several hours before embarking on a continuous flow of activity until late at night. He accomplished a huge workload with effortless serenity.
He taught in every free moment of the day, tirelessly responding to all requests for instruction and spiritual guidance. He died in Bhutan in 1991. Quote, pure perception, the extraordinary outlook of the adamantine vehicle, is to recognize the Buddha nature in all sentient beings and to see primordial purity and perfection in all phenomena. Every sentient being is endowed with the essence of Buddhahood, just as oil pervades every sesame seed. Ignorance is simply to be unaware of this Buddha nature, like a poor man who does not know that there is a pot of gold buried beneath his hovel. The journey to enlightenment is thus a rediscovery of this forgotten nature, like seeing the ever-brilliant sun again as the clouds that have been hiding it are blown away. Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche. Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro is widely thought to have been the greatest master of many Tibetan Buddhist lineages of the 20th century. Although himself the abbot of a Shakya monastery, his chief affiliation was Nyingma, and he was a leading exponent of the Rime approach to Tibetan Buddhism. The Rime, pronounced Rime and meaning no boundaries, movement began in the 19th century in eastern Tibet, where a number of lamas belonging to different traditions met together and exchanged initiations so as to create a more unified tradition. Rinpoche's predecessor, Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo, also known as Jamyang Khyentse the Great, played a significant part in the founding of the movement. Sangharakshita has always thought it significant that he had a strong personal connection with Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, a representative of ecumenical Tibetan Buddhism, because the Triratna Buddhist community tries to follow the same approach with regard to the whole Buddhist tradition. Rinpoche himself was very learned and very widely read, as Sangharakshita explains on one of his first meetings with him, quote, he looked up from his book, a very grey and dignified figure, very regal, but very kindly, and said to me, do you know anything about dancing? And I had to say no, because I didn't. So he said, pity, I've been reading about dancing. In the Kanjur, there are several works on dance, and I've been studying them recently. Of course, those Indian works on dance are the choreographic basis of the Tibetan so-called Lama dances. That's why he was interested and why he was studying them. But this just illustrated the extent of his studies and his researches. He was reading all these texts on dance and wanted to gather further information on the subject if he could, even from Western sources. He was a little bit disappointed that I couldn't tell him anything about dance. End quote. Jamyang Khyentse Chokyi Lodro was born in 1893. His father was a tantric master and himself the son of a Tertan. When he was seven, the nephew of Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo recognized Rinpoche as the action emanation of his uncle and took him to Kathok Monastery. When Rinpoche was 10 years old, his tutor Kenpo Thupten Rigsin became ill and Rinpoche nursed him personally, cooking, washing him, fetching water and so on, until he died 3 years later. Rinpoche later said that this service of his not only pleased his tutor, it also purified his own qualities. When he was 15, the young Khyentse Tulku at Dzongsa Monastery, the seat of Khyentse Wangpo, died, and Rinpoche was installed in his place. There was a great deal of opposition to his taking over the seat there, but the young Rinpoche faced the challenge and slowly calmed everything down with his skill, fearlessness, tolerance and compassion. Over the subsequent years, he travelled throughout Tibet, receiving teachings and initiations in all the main schools. He spent many years in retreat and was widely acclaimed as a master of all the many Tibetan Buddhist traditions. He was a renowned visionary, and many miraculous incidents were attributed to him. At the age of 56, he married Khandro Tsering Chodron, who is now regarded as the foremost female master in Tibetan Buddhism. In 1955, age 63, he arrived in India and, after making an extensive pilgrimage, based himself at the palace chapel of the King of Sikkim. Sangharakshita met him in 1957 and asked him for the Manjugosha initiation. Rinpoche, however, decided to give him the initiations of Avalokiteshvara, Vajrapani and Green Tara as well. He then commissioned a tanka for Sangharakshita that depicted the four bodhisattvas and 19 great Buddhist teachers. Sangharakshita himself was shown twice, once teaching the Dharma and once meditating in a cave. Rinpoche explained that through this initiation he had transmitted to Sangharakshita the essence of all the teachings of all the gurus in the tanka. Sangharakshita was now, he said, their spiritual heir and successor. Sangharakshita has described how Rinpoche looked while conducting this ordination. He seemed to be gazing upwards at the actual rainbow-bodied forms of the bodhisattvas themselves, just as if he were actually seeing them there, like old friends, and effecting an introduction between them and Sangharakshita. By virtue of Rinpoche's spiritual eminence and the nature of this particular initiation, Sangharakshita thinks of Rinpoche as his root guru. Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, Dujom Rinpoche and Chetul Sandorje maintained a particularly close connection with one another. They had a number of disciples in common. One day a discussion arose among some of those disciples as to which of the three was the greatest and most enlightened. So one of the disciples was deputed to ask Rinpoche which Lama was the greatest of the three. Was there one of them who was more enlightened or spiritually developed than the other two? Rinpoche heard the questioner out and then nodded and replied, "Yes, yes, very interesting. As a matter of fact, out of the three of us, one is definitely more enlightened than the other two. But you people will never know which one." In the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, Sogyal Rinpoche paints a vivid picture of this great teacher. Quote, "My master Jamyang Khyentse was tall for a Tibetan, and he always seemed to stand a good head above others in a crowd. He had silver hair cut very short and kind eyes that glowed with humour. His ears were long like those of the Buddha. But what you noticed most about him was his presence. His glance and bearing told you that he was a wise and holy man. He had a rich, deep, enchanting voice, and when he talked, his head would tilt slightly backward, and the teaching would flow from him in a stream of eloquence and poetry. And for all the respect and even awe which he commanded, there was humility in everything he did." End quote. Rinpoche had a profound respect for all the Buddhist traditions and worked tirelessly to overcome inter-Buddhist sectarianism. As he wrote in The Opening of the Dharma, quote, "The Buddha's many vehicles, his paths of wisdom and insight, such as Mahayana and Hinayana, are without any limit, and the various traditions of the different practices of Dharma are profound beyond all imagination.
the lion of the Shakyan clan, the all-knowing master, has turned the wheel of Dharma on three different occasions. With the first turning, the Buddha eliminated the incorrect view of not believing in cause and effect. With the next turning, the Buddha eliminated the incorrect view of the inherent existence of an independent ego identity, the basis for deluded ego grasping. With the last turning, the Buddha eliminated the basis of wrong views altogether, that is, the belief in the independent inherent existence of any phenomenon whatsoever, permanent or impermanent. Taking refuge is the stable and secure foundation of all the paths to enlightenment and of all other vows. It is what differentiates Buddhists from non-Buddhists and what protects us from harm from either humans or the spirits. By taking refuge, all our wishes for happiness, both in this lifetime and in future ones, will be fulfilled. Therefore, we must completely entrust ourselves to the three jewels of refuge, to the Buddha, the true teacher, to the Dharma, the true protection, and to the Sangha, the true guides. We must not take refuge just with our words, but from our hearts, having developed the complete confidence that the three refuges will never disappoint us. Then we must be very careful to honour always our commitments. The Sangha community of Buddhists should all be friendly to each other, and we must abandon all divisive talk of sectarianism. Do not take sides and say that this is my sect and that is his sect. Do not fabricate contradictions among the teachings of the many traditions of the Buddha, for there are none. Do not abandon being disrespectful to the Dharma by saying there are contradictions in its various traditions. The teachings of the Buddha are as vast and deep as the ocean. We must understand that all the teachings are intended as methods for taming our minds, and we must put them into sincere practice accordingly. Externally, we should be peaceful and relaxed, with our body, speech and mind always under control. Inwardly, we must have self-awareness at all times, mustering the forces of alertness and memory. As for myself, I am close now to my death and am experiencing the sufferings of old age. All I can do now is have good and pure wishes for the preservation of the Dharma. Although I have no powers or abilities to benefit directly the teachings of the Buddha, I am always making efforts in praying for propagation of the Dharma. End quote. Rinpoche died in 1959. Most of his remains are enshrined in a small golden stupa in the Royal Chapel in Sikkim.